Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
I'm going to approach this this Torah portion from a particular perspective that is not necessarily traditional. But before I go into my perspective of how I'm going to approach this and dissect this, any comments or questions regarding the Torah portion itself? Because I'm going to cover specifically the items associated with Moses and the way he is doing this work, the details behind them, and how they parallel many different components of our Messiah in different ways. So before I get to my spiel, is there any comments or questions we have about the Torah portion specifically, or of course, obviously Solomon's Temple or Hebrews that I can answer now because I may not get to them otherwise. All right. But any questions, we'll go before then. So Exodus, go back to Exodus chapter 20 or 38, sorry. In this Torah portion, we have a few different details. Obviously covers accounting. So we all know what accounting is. The basic principle of making a record of far as what you use and how much you use and where the money and such goes. And of course, obviously point to Itamar, which is Aaron's third youngest son, not quite, maybe fourth youngest son, not positive on that one, is in charge of that process. And of course, Bezalel with Aholiab and a few other people are in charge of the fabric itself. My point, before I go too far into this, into my spiel regarding Moses, there's a couple of details to pay attention to. So we have obviously individuals that have been assigned or given tasks to do. Those tasks are obviously designed to accentuate or utilize their skill level. Not that you have to answer this question, but ask yourself, what skill level do I have? What am I good at? What did God assign me to do? What task was I built for? All these questions we have throughout our lives many, many times, whether we are successful at what we think we're supposed to do or we're unsuccessful at what we think we're supposed to do, we still ask ourselves the same question. Why am I here? Why did God choose me? What good am I doing? What am I supposed to be doing versus what I am doing? All those questions happen across everybody's mind all the time throughout your lives. So that's pretty normal, and that's a good thing. And we have to evaluate and check ourselves. So in this case, I would ask you, don't answer the question, but think about it when you go through your life in general. The man Bezalel, I'm going to misspell his name because it's spelt in English and it's not how you pronounce it, right? Bezalel and, of course, Aholiab, right? It's an I. Holy up. These two individuals, they're artists, right? Obviously, Bezalel is in charge of most of the work, work being done, and Holy up was in charge of most of fabric materials and weaving being done. So these two men are artists. I do not know what they thought when they were children. I don't know what they thought when they were young men. But whatever they were thinking, whatever their task in life, whatever interests they were doing when they were expanding or exploring their skill level and learning how to do things and becoming tradesmen, of course, obviously artists to some degree in this business, I'm sure they had no clue they're going to be doing this work. I highly doubt they imagined as children they were building God's house, which is interesting or fascinating because, oh, Isaac, would you feel, will you eat a cloth I can erase this with? Because when I grow up or grew up, when each of us go through our lives, whether we're young, middle-aged, or old, we didn't imagine what we were going to be doing in our lives as we went through this process. We were young. We had these ideas or dreams as some wish to be musicians. Congratulations, Jeff. You are a musician to some degree. And of course, I don't think you thought about being a journalist when you were a teenager. I doubt. But maybe you did. I don't know. I didn't envision being an engineer when I was a teenager either. It's just how it turns out. So in these life that we make, we don't necessarily know why our skill level is there or what our task is, but the point is God can utilize any of them at any point in time when he sees fit. And that's where we have to take our consolus or our strength in, knowing that whatever purpose we have, whatever service we are able to do, the point is it is for God as his function because he built us to do that. I'm bringing this out to you because I'm not going to go transition into Moses. Moses, when he was an infant, obviously did not imagine himself being the savior of Israel. But of course, he wound up being one, of course. But that's how it went out. In Moses' work, as well as Bezalel and Aholiabs, all their work, they have their skills and their tasks that God assigned or God designed or built these individuals for. He had it pre-planned in his mind, his plan. I'm going to make these individuals to do these particular tasks, and then I will assign them the tasks when they're ready to go. And that task arrives, the timing arrives. In this instance, we have obviously a comparison in which I just discussed, Bezalel and Aholiab. We have one in Moses himself. So Moses may not have thought of himself when he was a teenager or when he was a young man that he would be the savior of Israel, the Messiah, so to speak. I say, by the way, Messiah is more of a generic term. It's not. I'm not referring to Moses being Jesus. I'm referring to the generic savior, saving of Israel, which is more common. So Moses, I don't believe necessarily imagined himself as being the savior of Israel when he was a young man, but he may have as he appreciated and learned more through Egypt's life, living in Egypt, that is. But the responsibilities that God gave to Moses, what were they? The biggest one, obviously, was save God's people.
People.
He said, with the burning bush, you know, go back, say, I heard cry, deliver them, you bring them out of Egypt. That was Moses' primary job that God assigned to him, at least the primary first job, I should say. I said the primary job, but his first job got assigned to him was go save my people, go save God's people. They'll let my people go. Well, in this instance, in this example we have, this is what we call a savior, a Yeshua, so to speak, or not that he was Yeshua, but what is the concept of salvation or being saved that Moses was assigned to do. So Moses, of course, was given this task to do this, and he did it, right? So in a matter of speaking, Moses is a prototype or a precursor or whatever you want to word it, of Messiah himself. When later on we find out about Yeshua, Moses is one of the biggest or primary examples of our Messiah in our entire Bible. He is the most exhaustive example of it. In every aspect Moses does, he focuses his whole life about this. You'll recall, maybe you recall, maybe you don't, but I don't recall the address. To write down the address, but it's written down somewhere that Messiah, Jesus, Yeshua, whatever you call him, specifically states that Moses wrote about him. I think it's John 5? It's John chapter 5, I think it is. Anyway, Moses wrote about him, and that was what Moses wrote about. Well, you look back at Moses, if I read Moses' writings, Moses writes dominantly about himself and what he did with God. That's almost all he did. Everything God told him, Moses repeats. Everything God told him to do, as far as instructions, how to do things, Moses repeats. Everything Moses writes about is repetition of what God tells him. It's all about Moses and God. So if that's the majority of what Moses wrote about, then bells go off your head. That means that's what Jesus was about. So when Jesus pointed out that Moses wrote about it, pretty sure John chapter 5, Moses wrote about him, and that's what he was, his focus was, then everything Moses does is geared toward our Messiah. And in the particular one, this building of tabernacle is a straw. Oh, thank you. John 5, 46. Thank you. I appreciate that. I couldn't remember the address. So John 5, verse 46. I knew it was John 5. I couldn't remember the two of us. So Moses' function, as far as his whole writing and everything he does, is geared toward Messiah in one capacity or another. We're going to cover a few of those today in our Torah portion. So the first one being Moses' assigned tasks. So he was given, obviously, to save God's people, but in this Torah portion, he is giving tasks out. Actually, said giving them out. They're being accomplished, or they have been accomplished by people. So we had Itamar, I think it's just Itamar, and then you had Bezalel, you had Aholiab. Now, Itamar, oh, that's an R, not a D, terrible letter. Bad penmanship, Daniel. Itamar. Itamar was the accountant. I can spell accountant. And then Bezalel was art, and so was Aholiab was art. Who was missing in this list? Moses. Was Moses the accountant? No. Was Moses the artist? No. Was Moses the weaver? No. Was Moses doing the physical labor of these tasks? No. Why not? Why not? Why doesn't Moses do this work? Now, when we also finally get down to Taylor, I think it's chapter 39, it says that God tells Moses to assemble the entire tabernacle. Now, I do realize this is where I deviate from standard Jewish thought. Jewish thought, Jewish rabbinical tradition is that Moses assembled the entire tabernacle himself, all by himself, with no assistance in any capacity, and he assembled it every day. He assembled it the first day of the first month, as God commanded. But before sun went down, he disassembled it. And they teach the second day, he reassembled it again, all by himself. Each day, all the way through until, of course, the time which you would assign or anoint Aaron and his family. That is Jewish tradition. I disagree with that because I think it's completely absurd. Let's see. And Moshe was the manager. And yeah, Ark would be heavy to lift. heavy task. Yes, Moses, the manager. Correct. And that's the beautiful part. So Moses, the manager. Now I'm going to add a few names here. They're not in our Torah portion, but maybe you'll see why I'm adding them. So I put Moses right above him. I'm going to put Yeshua here. Okay. No, I'm not saying Moses and Yeshua are the same person. They're wrong. I'm putting his name on there for a comparison. And then we have, of course, an accountant who's in charge of making sure everything's done according to Moses. I put another person's name there. I'm not saying he was an accountant, mind you. I'm just putting his name there as an example of an office who so-and-so filled. So the so-and-so, I'm going to arbitrarily select a person's name. I'm going to call him Peter. You may disagree. It's okay. Bezaleel, I'll put another apostle's name there. We'll call him James. I was actually Yaakov. We'll call it Jacob. I know it's James in our English Bibles, but his name was Jacob. So call the guy's name. And we also have, I'll put another apostle. I'll just choose arbitrarily. I'm going to choose Paul. Why not? Do you get my point where I'm leading with this? Is that these men and all the apostles, you have obviously the Levi. That's Matthew. I apologize, Matthew. His name was Levi, but we call him Matthew. You had all the apostles' names. There's I forgot all the names. That's something I should have remembered, but I forgot all the names. It doesn't matter. The point is, Moses assigned. He was given a task. Hey, God says, Moses, go build this thing for me. And Moses is given the vision or the description of what it looks like. So Moses knows what it's supposed to look like, how it's supposed to appear, what parts belong, that kind of thing. And he is following God's instruction as God said so. But Moses doesn't do the physical actual building, does he? As God even explicitly stated, I have selected these other individuals to do the work. And you recall the Messiah himself also states the individuals that he selected, God is the one who gave them to him. So God is the person who selected Peter. God's the person who selected Jacob. God's the person who selected Paul. God's the person who selected, Jesus didn't select them. God did. Jesus is doing exactly what Moses is doing, because Jesus points out, I do nothing that my Father has not shown me. So everything that Jesus does, Yeshua does, the Father has shown him to do. And at the end of Jesus' his story during the Gospels, he points out to God, all the people whom you've given me, Peter, Jacob, Levi, all the apostles, I have not lost one. So even Messiah points out that these are all the individuals that God himself selected. So we know in our Torah portion, God selected individuals to do certain tasks. And in our New Testament understanding, God selected individuals that also do certain tasks. Now, Yeshua, we say, oh, well, he's our Savior. He's our Messiah. He's all these great things. That's true. But is he the one who actually built God's house? I'm not referring to Moses' house. I am referring to the church or the beginning or the foundation of those who follow him. The answer, obviously, is no, he didn't. He specifically states to Peter, I believe it's in, where he calls Peter the rock. Matthew 16, that's it, Matthew 16. I did write that down. That you're the foundation, the stone which I build this whole congregation, all these people on. You are the beginning. But God is the one who selected Peter, not Jesus. Peter obviously had to choose to follow, agree to follow, but God selected him. So each individual, just like Moses didn't physically build the house, Jesus didn't physically build his church either. All these men did. And women too. There were women involved. Don't be wrong. Sorry, not being sexist. Men and women, but there are a lot of women involved here too. A lot of them. So these people, these individuals God selected, they're the ones who actually do physical hard labor. As Jesus pointed out, the fields are white, the laborers are few, right? Well, these are our laborers. So Moses and Messiah are actually very similar in their comparison, their stories, because it makes sense. Moses is a messianic figure, one of the biggest, best ones we have for the Messiah himself. So in this storyline, when we look at this task, we note that, well, Just like Itamar and Bezalel and Aholiab were not the same person, they had different skill levels, different tasks, different assigned instructions to do. Well, guess what? Peter and Yaakov and Paul and Levi also are not the same person. They also have their own specialties, their own unique tasks, which they successfully did. And of course, like the case of Levi and Paul and Yaakov, they were both all executed for it, but except Peter. But the rest were executed for it. But the point is that they were given tasks, God selected them for it, and they did those tasks as best they could. They are distinctly different from each other. They disagreed, if you notice. They disagreed with each other at times. they didn't all agree the same philosophies or ideas. But they had their own tasks. They were given their own job. They did it. But Yeshua didn't do the work. They did. Just like Moses didn't do the work, these three men were in charge, did it. But the vision, the instruction, meaning what is this building supposed to look like? Oh, thank you for it. The 12 apostles, thank you. It was Andrew, Simon or Peter, Yaakov, Ben Zebedee, Yochanan Ben Zebedee, then Philip, Bartholomew, Levi, / Matthew. Okay. And then there's Yaakov Ben Alphaeus. I don't remember that guy's name. Thaddeus, Simon Zealot, and Judas Iscariot. Alphaeus? I should remember that. I've looked that guy up. I can remember him. Anyway, it doesn't matter. these are things I should remember as a child and I forget them. It's like the Ten Commandments. Memorize them as a kid and then as you get older, you forget. Although I didn't do that. I did the poor guy's names. The point is that they were in charge of stuff. I digress. So these men, Yeshua and Moses. Moses was given the vision, meaning what God, showed Moses, what God wanted to see. So God the Father is telling Moses, I want to look like this. Match what you see, match what I've shown you. This is what it looks like. So Moses isn't doing the work. He's relaying as much information as he can to the individuals who are going to do the work, and they'll do it as best they see fit. So yeah, Moses the leader, unless the leader or manager is doing the job. Yeshua is the exact same thing. So the Father told Yeshua, this is what I want it to look like. Here are the people you're going to pick. Or I should say, tap on the shoulder. God picked them. And they're going to do tasks. And Jesus said, I'll do exactly what you said. I do everything the Father showed me. Just like Moses does everything God commanded him. You will note in our Torah portion, I lost count. I just should have counted them all accurately. How many times it says, as God commanded Moses? There's got to be at least, 10 or 12 times God says, it repeats, they did this as God commanded Moses, as God commanded Moses, as God commanded Moses. Well, guess what Yeshua's doing? He's doing the thing as God commanded Yeshua, meaning God has set this up. Yeshua's following the sequence, following the pattern, because Yeshua says he did the exact same thing. Whatever God has shown him, he's doing. Just like with the people of Moses, whatever God shows Moses, the people they're doing. It's a duplicate. It's a mirror image of each other. So Moses and Yeshua are all being directed by God to do certain tasks. And they're mimicking each other in many ways. This is just my point number one. There's more here. Okay. So hopefully I'll lose you on this point, because now point number two on how Moses and Yeshua are similar in this Torah portion. I'm not telling the entire Torah. That's ridiculous. Just this Torah portion we're discussing. All right. There's tons of more stuff in the similarities for these individuals throughout the entire Torah, but we're not covering 100% of them. That would be excessive. So in this Torah portion, we also have a few things that come along with it. So let's jump, we're jumping ship a little bit here to, oh, not jump, advance forward, I should say, to the silver. I did not do an exhaustive study on gold and silver and copper, okay? There are people who do that, and I've tried to do it once before, and it didn't turn out so well, so I won't do it again. It's really complicated. But I do know a little bit about silver itself, a small fraction of an ounce of information. So we know the standard common stuff, right? You're supposed to purify silver. God's, I'll purify you like silver, refine silver. At least in, I forgot which prophet. Which one of the prophets? I want to say like Malachi or something. And it does matter. I'm going to purify you like silver. Silver. So we have, I'm going to draw a cartoonish diagram. So I have planks that represent the walls of the tabernacle, and they're three-dimensional walls. I'm terrible at drawing this. Anyway, and they have different shapes and such, but they have sockets on the bottom that's supposed to hold these planks up. And our Torah portion discusses each socket was made from silver, right? Okay, makes sense. All made from silver. And there's one talent. You can spell that correctly. That's an L. One talent per socket worth of silver. Now, the silver itself was, it goes out of its way. Now, mind you, so the people donated stuff, right? They donated fabric, they donated gold, they donated obviously copper, they donated gems, precious things are donated. But the silver was something uniquely done. God said the silver is not going to be donated the same way that gold and copper or fabrics or gems were donated. It's done differently. The silver was done strictly by the census. It was accounting. So it's unlike the other metals, silver was done differently in that it is an accounting process, which is, again, our torpor starts out with the accounting. So the census was the source of silver. 600,000 and plus some change of people. That's like all the talents of silver for it. I find this fascinating because the silver is usually, before you can pour it into a mold of any value, is purified to some level. Because it, for those of you who ever, to don't confuse silver with sterling silver. Silver is a blend of copper and silver. Silver itself is not sterling silver. It's a blend. It's a different. So sterling silver was invented many, many years ago to try to reduce the tarnish that silver naturally accumulates with oxidization. Copper does it too. Turns out when you mix both metals together, the tarnishing of the silver and copper diminishes. It just happened that both metals worked it that way. That's why they made sterling silver. So it's a blended. It's unusual to have two types of things, both with bad properties, mixed together. You get a better product. That's rare. But silver and copper happen to do that. Most don't, but that one does. But silver, normal silver, or whole silver, or complete silver, I'm not saying how pure it has to be purified to some level. They burn all the pure impurities off. And we know that God does purification silver. So I'll refine the people that, in particular, he refers to the priesthood. I before E, I can spell. Defines a priesthood, I'll refine you as silver. I think it's like seven times. I forgot the address where that was written, but it's written down somewhere. Seven times over, refine you as silver. Well, the silver refining process, you obviously melt it. It's a liquid. When you can see your reflection, all the impurities are gone. Now it's done and it's pure. So they melt it down and burn off all the excessive stuff they don't want to make silver. But the silver came from the people themselves. I bring this up because in the description that Peter gives in, I think it's 1st and 2nd Peter. I think it's 1st Peter. A second? No, 2nd Peter. No, 1st Peter. Oh, whatever. In Peter. One of the books, Peter, discusses that the people themselves are the foundation of God's house. They're what builds God's house. And I find this interesting because the silver itself that God had told them, and God is the one who ordered the census, God is the one who told them how to take the census, God is the one who told them what to use that silver for. He didn't say use it for anything. It was specifically used for this. And they also had clasp rings at the very top, which held the boards together too. So he had the foundation, which were one talent. The clasp rings were small. They were small little rings. I don't know how much they weighed, but they were like a donut, little donut shape. They think it's a donut shape type of ring. So, but the point is that the God is one who ordered something special about the silver itself, that they are the foundation of this tabernacle. So you know that every one of these little foundation pieces holds the walls up. So if the foundation falls, meaning if the talents aren't there, the whole wall falls down, there is no tabernacle anymore, which is a pile of mess. So the point being that symbolically speaking, God went out of his way to select silver for this purpose. So that means, and he had the people, the individual ordinary schmoes like myself, supply this silver through the counting process, meaning I'm being counted as part of God's family, and here is my record of my count. My hat is in the ring, so to speak. This is part of my. Now, I'm not sure which part I got melted into, but the point is, I'm part of this foundation. And it's the people that did it, all the people, not, however, the Levites, not them. They were not part of the foundation, which I think is fascinating itself, why God excluded them out. These are ordinary people, not priests, okay? Priests are different, ordinary people are different. So this foundation was all built upon these people, these individuals make the foundation of God's house, which again makes perfect sense because what is the house of God made of today? What is Messiah's church? We use the church loosely, but what is that foundation made of? Of you and me and him and her and her. It's a people. Imagine going to a church where there's no one there. Imagine going to a synagogue and it's an empty show. It's a great dance hall by yourself. There's no one there. It's an empty building. What is it? Some rock and some wood and some concrete, some metal. And that's been sucked to me. Sucked to me. It wouldn't be anything. Without the people themselves, a church isn't a church. A group of people isn't a group of people. It's nothing. It's just an empty building. I could use it for a church if I wanted to, or as my wife pointed out, or maybe I'll use it as a dance hall. I can use it for anything I want because it's not a church anymore. It's the people that make that church. So God's house is made up of people just like we would make a church up of people. It's the same thing. And of course, let's jump to, it is 1 Peter. Remember that? 1 Peter. 1 Peter talks about this concept or this idea. So 1 Peter chapter 2. That's what we messed up. It was chapter 2, not 2 Peter. So 1 Peter, find 1 Peter. There it is. 1 Peter chapter 2 discusses this concept, this symbol being discussed here. We'll jump to, from 1 Peter chapter 2, jump to verse 4. Well, through verse 4 through, actually, you can read the entire chapter. I'm going to go the whole chapter. We'll go through verse 4. We'll probably stop somewhere around 9 or 10. Verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels, that's 2 Peter. There it is. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. There it is. We'll start verse 4. Come to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God as precious. You also are living stones, being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifice acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in the scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect and precious, and he who believes in him will by no means put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious, but to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become a cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumble being disobedient to the word to which they were also appointed. But you are chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into this marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have attained mercy. Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Stop there for a minute. So in this, he points out that you, I, me, our group, the people of the whole world who are following Messiah to some level, I'm not going to bicker about this, what capacity you follow God. But the point is, you're following to some level, is that stone, the foundation stone that he's building on. And I pointed out, I kept reading a little bit in there about our conduct. You know, everybody says, well, I bet you as sojourners abstain from fleshly lusts, which works the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. Well, what does our entire Torah teach us? Conduct, how you live your life, what you do, what you don't do. What's acceptable to God, what isn't acceptable to God. That's our entire Torah in a nutshell, both in religious, moral, or civil laws. It's what does God accept and what does he not accept? So even Peter points out that this foundation stone, whether it's a silver socket or rock in Solomon's temple, is a still foundation. It's your conduct. Conduct is what makes you that stone. Hence the silver, a good conductor. yeah, good pun there. The conduct makes you your stone. If your conduct is poor, are you then pure silver or contaminated silver? Contaminated. You would not be good, not be useful. If your rock is weak, are you a very good foundation stone? No, because you crumble. The point is, your conduct defines whether you're a good foundation or a poor foundation. So Moses, when he's coming along and saying, okay, God said to build all these things, which is good, God said to build them, does it look like this is the size of sockets they're going to be made from? This is the silver you're going to use, the silver from the people. And that silver obviously gets cleaned. I can't say how clean they had to be for the sockets because I wasn't there. But typically it gets cleaned to some level because it's melted down, which will in itself will cause purification by the melting process. And the whole point being that your conduct is the distinguishing characteristic that makes you God's people or not God's people, as 1 Peter 2 talks about. Our conduct makes us this category or does not make us that category, depending on whether it's good or bad. So, and God selected silver for this purpose. And Moses, did he pour the silver? No, he did not pour the silver. Did he refine it? No, he did not refine it. Did he do anything with the silver? No, he did not do anything with the silver. Who did? Well, we had Bezalel did it. Bezalel. Eliab was put mostly in the fabric. That's it. Eliab was only a fabric, but they had different fabric weaving he did. The point is that these men are the ones who did it. They're the ones who did the task. So just like Moses said, okay, God's telling you, you will build this tabernacle this way using these, symbolic speaking, people as its foundation. And then these men carried it out. Messiah is the same way. Messiah, Yeshua, he said, okay, here's my church. Here's my church, and it has foundation stones, which include obviously the apostles themselves, but those apostles also had to build more. So they had to build more people as a foundation of this house of God. In English or Greek, call it church, or ecclesia, or church, this house of God, to be a people that wasn't a people before, but now you're God's people. These are very, very similar comparisons. They're not identical, of course, but they are similar. That leaves me on this so far, because I'm not done yet. I mean, this is point number two. We're going to point number three. Got you so far? I didn't lose anybody? All right. Got any questions? Feel free to ask. I'll answer any of them. Even the uncomfortable ones. I'll answer this. I'll ask this. And I'll entertain those too. Okay. Let's go to point number three. Okay. See, holy silver find. Got that one. Hammered. Oh, sorry. I jumped that. I can't do hammered yet. Let's see. I covered the Moses. So yeah, we'll have to go through. We'll go to bells and pomegranates in a minute. So let's go to gold. Those of you who know a little bit, a very small amount more about metals than I do, which I'm sure a number of you probably do. I don't know much, a little bit, but I know the common ones, you know, steel, chrome, you know, nickel, that kind of thing. So they have gold. So gold, I did not do an exhaustive study on gold, by the way. This is just a note point to pay attention to. So you've probably have heard of pure gold being classified as near or at 24 karat gold. Well, you've probably heard that before. Maybe you have it. I don't know. This is a modern definition. All right. All the karat classifications are modern definitions. They aren't like 3,000 years old type of thing. But the gold considered pure gold used to be called pure gold. We modern day would call somewhere between 16 to 18 karat. We would classify that as what we would call it. But back in biblical times, that'd be considered called pure gold. That's as pure as they could get it. They couldn't get it more refined than that. And the property about this karat gold category is you can work hard in it. Have you noticed God says over and over and over again, you'll make it out of hammered work? He didn't cast it. They hammered it. You know what I'm saying? Probably said when they play example, menorah was made out of hammered work. And the thread, which is our Torah portion today, the gold thread they used was out of hammered work. So those of you who know how to make metal thread, pure metal thread, I don't have a color of blue water, but I'll pretend this is a cup of water in it. Okay. This is my cup. Here's my bowl. With a little spout on it, has gold in it, a big G for gold, okay? The bowl's hot, it's liquid. And I would pour a small amount of gold in a little stream into the water, or it could be oil. Anyway, there's something that's cold. And that stream, when it hits the water, would sizzle, water sizzles, right? As it gets really hot, that gold leaves a long, stringy thread. This is not hammered at all. This is cast. This is what you do. You cast and you melt the gold, and you quenched it in some kind of a liquid. You can use water, you can use oil, basically something that's cold. That would cause an impurity in the gold in the process, because if you use oil, but if you use water, it has some impurities into it. They did not do this. This is not, God said, no, you will not use this method to make gold thread, right? You will instead take sheets of gold or bars of gold and hammer them with a hammer. Smack, smack, smack. And you will flatten them out into long, thin sheets. All right. I can't say how long they are, but just the thin sheets. And then you will, in order to make those thin sheets in the thread, you have to cut them with a knife. I'll pick a big knife here. I can't do a very good knife. I cut the sheets of the knife to make my threads. All right. Now you say, why do I care? I'm going to tell you why you care. I did all this because this has a reason for it. This gold in category, which they would call pure gold, it work hardens, which means as you smash it, because it's not pure gold, it gets stronger. All right. Because it's not pure gold. If you did pure gold to a carat, no good luck, never happen. But if it's this classified acacia of gold, it gets stronger when you smash it. This gold into the water process, the gold does not strengthen. It's still weak. It's like you with the gold. It's not a very strong metal. This process being this classification of carat gold, it gets stronger when you smash it. Now, when you cut it into strips and weave it into fabric, it doesn't break. That's a good thing, right? And note, many of the things God used when he said to make gold, they were all out of hammered work. But the ark has hammered gold. The menorah is hammered gold. Yeah, the fabric is hammered gold. These are all hammered gold. No gold noodles in the house of God. Exactly, no gold noodles. They're all, well, actually, if you see the way my mother makes noodles, yes, this is exactly how she makes noodles. She smashed it out and sliced it. Anyway. Anyway, so the point being that you've made something that is weak, you made it stronger by hammering it. We also know the term hammering as to distress or stress the metal. So God used pure gold in that class, what they understood as pure, which is this rough category of pure gold characterization. To make God use it, it's stressed to make it stronger. And now it is usable. That's the point. He stresses gold, making it stronger, and now he can use this part of his house. Now his house are made of people. Was that? He does it us too. The house made of people. So when we're hammered, not referring to being drunk, not referring to being stressed. When we're stressed, we have difficulties, struggles come, we get stronger. This is not the same as the silver, which is purified. We're talking strength, the hammering strength. So we get stronger when we're stressed. Now we think, no, I get sicker. You're right. I do get sicker when I'm stressed too. But we're referring to stress of a moral stress or a character stress. Now we're talking like, you know, your body's, you know, you've injured yourself or work stress. The point of stress is that now you become stronger. And now as a stronger metal, you are now usable. You can hold your strength and hold your shape in difficult times for application. So in God's house, you are a stronger individual in God's house. That's a good thing. Now let's go bring this to Messiah again. So this methodology of gold, I didn't cover copper. I have some stuff about that, but I'm going to cover that today. So Yeshua, just like Moses, both of these individuals, we would say were definitely stressed, right? Was Yeshua stressed? If you're not sure, jump up on a cross and get yourself nailed to it and slowly bleed and beat up, and we'll discuss when you're done, and we'll say, was that stressful or not? If you're not sure, we can address it. We can address it more currently or more clearly later. And in Moses' case, was he stressed? Yeah, you go before a Pharaoh and you get yourself almost slaughtered as a child by dumping the water, kill a guy, run for your life, and be God speaks to you, go back, tell Pharaoh, let people go, and Pharaoh says, no, I'm like, and do this whole process of the miracles. All the while, your people you're trying to save are telling you, bug off, okay? We don't believe you, God's not with you, go away. That's stressful, okay? That's stressful. Yeah, he tells God, I didn't ask for this. Why? I didn't give birth to these people. Why are you giving them to my problems? So yeah, Moses, he definitely was stressed. I would say, yes, he was stressed. He even talks about the fact this is hard. So Yeshua is stressed. He even sweated blood. So both these men are highly stressed, and God made them go through it, but the individuals they selected, oh, James, is considered all joy. Oh yes, James 1, I didn't write that one down. That's great. I'll read it out loud though. Thank you, Jeff. It says, James, this is chapter 1, verse 2 through 4. Consider all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let that endurance have its perfect results, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Excellent. Thank you, sir. This is why I like talking to Hello Fellowship. You guys are really helpful. The congregations don't help me that way. Anyway, let's see here. Where was it? Oh, yeah. So stress. So Yeshua is the most stressed. That's great. We understand that stress. Okay, terrible, difficult stress. What about the people that they had working for them? Did God stress them too? Let's ask. What about Aaron working for Moses? Was Aaron stressed? Well, he lost two sons. He watched them die, and he wasn't allowed to mourn their loss. That would be stressful, okay? He's an old man. That's not too easy. I was also being stressful too. And of course, was Moses prophet or messenger when all people wanted to stone him and Moses, you know, the rebellion Korah thing and the 10 spies, which we'll get to that in Book of Numbers. I think the man was probably stressed too. Remember when his sister Miriam was struck with leprosy, he pleaded, please don't let her die. Don't let her be like a walking dead or the one who's born in the womb dead. I would say Aaron was probably stressed too. Is it the same stress as Moses? No, it's different, but still very stressed. And Aaron's sons, obviously he had four sons. Two of them died, Nadab and Abihu, so I can't really talk about them. I think they were probably stressed, but I don't really know because they died. Okay, death is probably stressful. I think it probably is. I haven't experienced it yet, but when I do, I'll let you know. I think it's stressful, but maybe it's not. But yeah, Eleazar, I'll put an E and an I because I'm going to switch the whole names. Were these men stressed? In their own right, they were stressed in their own way, in that Eleazar, of course, goes through the whole process of the 40 years of wilderness and such, and his son continues on. And they have this issue with the whole, in Numbers, discusses where Phinehas steps up and kills Cosby and the guy from Simeon. I can't think of the guy's name, he's from the tribe of Simeon. But Eleazar is the high priest at that time, and this is stressful for him too, because all of Moses is stressed. Itamar, we don't know a lot about him, other than the fact he's in charge of essentially the entire tabernacle. Make sure it's done right. That can be stressful too. The point being that the people that Moses is working for him are also stressed in their own way. Not every stress is different, but they're all different. In Yeshua, when you have Peter, I had these guys. I should listen again. So James, there's a couple of, how many Jameses are there? There's two of them? That's not fair. Okay, that's harder. I'll just abbreviate. So you got J, covers the two Jacobs. You got Andrew, Bartholomew, all these various guys. We have stories about these guys and some of the stuff they wind up doing in their lives as far as it's recorded. Most of them die, are killed for their beliefs or their philosophies. Not all, but most are. And the people themselves, these individuals, as they went through their work, they were doing this very work. They were fishermen or ordinary people, taskless. That was their ordinary job, which I'm sure has its own stresses, you know, trying to make money as a fisherman. But the point is that when they go into this process, now you're supposed to go out there and teach the people about God, and everybody says, bug off. Sounds familiar. God's not with you. And is that stressful? It was stressful for Moses, stressful for them too. All these men were stressed as well. The point being that the stress process, God used, which I'm using here as gold, the hammered gold, God's using that as a good thing. And it didn't matter if it was Moses building God's house or Yeshua building God's house. It's still a stressful event, a stressful task. And that makes us, or individual people that God has selected to be stronger and useful. All right. The comparison of Yeshua and Moses, they're messianic figures for a reason. Well, obviously Yeshua is Messiah, but the point is that most messianic figure is supposed to picture what Moses does and the people and the tasks he goes through, just like Yeshua has his people and what he does, tasks he goes through. These are very similar characters, similar people that we study and follow. Did I lose anybody on this point? Hopefully I didn't lose anyone at this point. So let's go here. Should I go through? I already covered silver, so I won't. There's a point I forgot to mention on that one. I apologize. I should have mentioned this. 1 Peter also talks about in chapter 1 about your conduct is to be holy because God is holy. That's also repeated, of course, for the Torah. So let's go through this a little bit. I have, let's see here. I have bells and pomegranates discussed there. And then I have, I'm going to skip that one because this is an awesome one. Okay. I'm skipping point number 4. I'm going to skip to point number 5. Point number 4 is relatively small. It has to do with the pomegranates and the bells on the fabric, but I won't cover that. It's not terribly critical because more of an opinion as opposed to actual like evidence, like, you know, events. So we'll bypass the pomegranates. This part I think is cool because it shows something that is unique about Moses versus versus Aaron, and also Yeshua versus other individuals of following. So I mentioned the fact that they believe, or rabbinic traditions, Moses built the tabernacle and disassembled it every single day all by himself. That's ridiculous, but that's their philosophy. But I think it's ridiculous. I should be more careful. You're allowed to believe that. Don't get me wrong. You can believe Moses assembled the entire tabernacle himself and disassembled it from the morning he started. By evening, he had it disassembled again and redid it again every day. If you wish to believe so, that's perfectly fine. I just don't. Okay. There's a reason I don't. So in this assembly, which I think is pretty cool. So in the assembly process, I'm going to do a very, very rudimentary drawing here. Okay. So I have a tabernacle. It's roughly twice the length roughly. Let's little off that. It has a section here, which is holy, holy section. I should better job drawing. Yeah, I don't know, I'm living right. And it has, there's a menorah, and you have, it has a table here, and there's an altar somewhere. There's an altar here. Inside here, there's obviously the ark. Just a blobby area of the ark. And here's the entrance. I'll put a doorknob. Didn't have a doorknob, that's okay. So, rough tabernacle, right? So Moses assembles this thing, and of course has drapey things over the top of it, a roof that, who should get to this? Hey, that's not fair. I am. Oh, yeah, okay. I deserve that. Anyway. Oh, Jeff's making fun of my CAD drawing. Anyway. Let's see. So we have a tabernacle. So Moses assembles it and takes it down every day. Or not. However often he takes it down, I don't really care. What I find interesting is this point. So when God orders or instructs the high priest to utilize these items, okay, he uses these items. Do you remember, and actually it's recorded in Leviticus, I think. I believe Numbers 2. I can't remember exactly. When God's with the high priest has to purify them, he has to take a bowl of blood. I'll make this little bowl of blood here. And he has sprinkle little drips on top of the altars, on top of the ark. He has some on the menorah, some on this altar, the table. He sprinkles blood from an animal on these items. There's a certain number of sprinklings. He puts some here and there. It takes like 7 days or whatever to go this whole process, which he purifies all these things before he's allowed to use them. So the high priest, who in this case is Aaron and his sons, the high priest will put Aaron specifically because it matters. Before he uses any of these things or can use them officially in their official capacity, he has to purify them all with blood, which I think is gross, but that's what he does, okay? And they atones them for the people. And then he can then use them for offerings or incense burning. Whatever he's got to do, he then can use them. But Moses, no, Moses didn't have to. This is interesting. So Moses, before Aaron is purified as high priest, Moses has this whole thing assembled. And mind you, this is why I think the Jewish philosophy is weird. Before this stuff has its purpose, like before it's assigned, hey, this is used for this offering, this is used for God, that kind of thing, it's an ordinary piece of furniture, okay? So, for example, the workers who are hammering the gold with a hammer, smack, 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 I don't know if it's a wooden hammer or a steel iron hammer, some kind of hammer they were using, whatever they're using, that wasn't making it holy, okay? I wasn't using a big hammer, crushing this chunk of metal, and now this metal is holy while I'm crushing it. No, I'm just crushing metal. It doesn't become holy until it's dedicated for a purpose. Then it becomes holy. Does that make sense? So during the assembly process, I could have had any junk part yet. Obviously, don't destroy it. I suspect, my personal opinion, he probably had the Levites doing it, probably the actual assembly work, that they weren't doing the building process. Enough padding would make it holy. Enough would make it holy. You're right. Damage the whole thing. So in the assembly process, this one I think is interesting. When it gets assembled, it's fully functionally assembled, though the high priests are not allowed in yet. Aaron's family can't be allowed in yet. Moses, God tells Moses, anoint all of them not with blood. Anoint them with oil. Sprinkle oil on those items instead. So Moses, God orders him, you use oil on them. And once they are anointed with oil, then Moses lights the lights. Moses burns the incense. Moses does the altar offering. He does all this work. He gets it fully functional. Yet no blood was spilt. None of them were purified. Moses didn't do what the high priest did. The high priest wasn't allowed to, but Moses was. This is curious. To me, it's curious because it's awesome. Okay. Moses didn't have to purify himself for a week before he could do any of this stuff, like Aaron and his sons had to. He just did it immediately, right then and there, on the spot, day one. Get it up, get it anointed, light it, ready to go. He did it all. It's almost like he was greater than the high priest. He was chosen. He was greater than the high priest. Mind you, who anoints Aaron? Moses. Who purifies Aaron? Moses. Who makes the entire priesthood functional? Moses. And by law of all humanity, the greater less blesses the lesser. If the lesser is Aaron, then the greater would be Moses. Even Moses is the younger brother because he was chosen. He was selected to be that. So he didn't have to be like the high priest. He is his own priest, greater than the high priest himself, which is pretty cool because he did this stuff day one. Not, oh, I'm not ready yet. I have to hold another week to go. No, day one, he's ready. Mind you, Aaron was only alive because Moses said, God, don't kill him. God would have wiped him out because of the whole golden calf thing. So we have these individuals that we have the high priest think, oh, wow, they're so awesome. They're great. They're the highest. Why do they call them the high priest, right? The greatest of the priests and all the Levitical priests that follows, the sons and the sons of the sons of the grandsons. All, that's the high priest, the Levitical priesthood. Woohoo, awesome. But no, there is one that was greater than all of them, Moses. Now, was he some anointing process took place with Moses? Well, not directly, no. God just picked him. I'm choosing you. And did God talk to the high priest like did Moses? No, Moses talked face to face. Wouldn't you like to talk to God face to face, have a conversation with him? Obviously, not a one-sided one, but have a conversation, okay? Hey, what about this? Is that what you wanted? Tell me. That'd be awesome. Assuming it wasn't scary. I'm not sure how that... The scary might overwhelm my awesomeness. I'm not sure. But anyway, either way, I have the mix of awesome plus scary all mixed together. Anyway, the point is that Moses got that option. And so he, and by all accounts, is greater than the high priest. Even in the tabernacle, the house of God himself, he's greater than the high priest, which is pretty cool. Now we have our Messiah, okay? So I'll put Yeshua up here, okay? I'm not saying he's Moses, but just comparison. When Messiah is building God's house, okay? Who is the greatest in that house? Other than God himself, because obviously, house of God, Moses isn't greater than God. That's by definition. That goes without saying. So Yeshua's not greater than God himself, but building the house, who has free reign to walk? Moses clearly does. He goes into it all the time. So Moses can wander around. I can't say he went in the Holy of Holies after they got anointed the high priest. I don't know about that. But leading at this point, he did. So Moses can walk in and out. He has full reign and control over all of it. Hence, we have a comparison. Messiah as well has free reign and control over all of his house. And Messiah, just like Moses, are both greater than that priesthood. They're both greater than Aaron. They're both greater than the Levitical priesthood. They're both superior in every capacity. Because unlike the priesthood, these men can walk in on their own account, for their own ability, their own reasons. Obviously, our Hebrews argues because Jesus, it was Yeshua's blood, which is fine. Moses, I'm not sure what you'd argue for that, why God allowed him to walk in and out as he saw fit. But these individuals had full reign to do as they saw fit as God selected because these guys were chosen by God. They're picked. Unlike the high priest and Aaron, who was assigned. God picked them too, but they're assigned through Moses. Or if you're so inclined, you could choose any other person's name here. You go to Peter here if you want to. Or maybe you like Paul better. I don't care. Who's greater? The one who has free reign, the son of the house, the heir of all, the inheritor of everything. That's what it's about. These people, what was that? There's a question here. Yeah, Moses did everything God told him to do. Right. Right. Aaron had a golden calf. Moses did everything God told him to do. As our Torah portion repeats, they did everything according to what God commanded Moses. Everything matched as best they possibly could. All right. That would imply that guess what? Yeshua does everything God commanded him to do. He matched him as best he possibly could, just like Mr. Moses would have done. That's what makes them greater. Aaron, yeah, he had his mistakes. The golden calf's a great example of mistakes. All right. And the following priesthood, even Eleazar, His son, Phineas, stepped up to the plate with the Cosby, but Eleazar didn't. So Eleazar wasn't that strong of a leader. But Phineas, of course, was. I'll put a P. It should be an F. That's okay, because Greek does a PH instead of F. But it's whatever. The word is that even the high priest, and recall later on, there's a famous guy, Eli. Remember him? Yeah, she says, Eli and his two sons, exactly. Yeah, my kids know that story pretty well. they all have their problems, but these two were selected by God. Now, I'm not saying Moses had problems. He made his errors, so we were wrong. He was a murderer, recall? He killed a man without a trial. We call that murder. But God still selected, not after he was chosen, that was before he was chosen. God set that aside and said, I'm picking you anyway. So it wasn't that Moses had to be sinless. That wasn't the relevant point. When he was chosen, whatever he was chosen, whatever point that was, at that point, God said, now you're mine, and you have all this control and all this authority granted to Moses by God to do this. Just like John 5, Yeshua points out the exact same thing. All the authority, I have all the stuff given to me by God, because God selected me to do this. So he assigned me to do this task. I'm doing this task. This is what I'm doing. That's what makes him greater. So am I out of time? Ooh, I am out of time. So I will conclude with my last thing here. Unless any questions here. Skip that. Oh, right. This last part. I had to mention this part. So when this is all done, all finished, all said and done, this is great. So the thing's working, it's all been anointed. Here it all is. We have this concluding part in our Torah portion. I'll erase some of this stuff because I'm out of room. This Torah portion concludes, essentially mostly concludes, with God's presence. I'll put a big funky cloud here. Kind of God presence dwelling or moving into this new house he built. All right. So God moves in the house and everybody else gets out, including Moses. They all leave. So Moses and all Levites or whoever else is in the house, God moves in and they all move out. Essentially, Moses has turned this house over to God. It is now yours. I built it. Here is your house. Guess what? 1 Corinthians 15. When Yeshua is done building God's house, what's he supposed to do? So I'll put the word big word church, that's a G, that's a C, which has its own building structure, foundations, whatever you want to put as far as what church looks like. It's mostly made of people. Oops, that's a P. Yeah. Don't make fun of my spelling. That's an E. People. This church that Messiah is building, or actually Messiah's not technically building it, it's the followers, disciples are building it. At 1 Corinthians 15, it points out that when this is done, what's Yeshua going to do? Get out, because God takes ownership. It's now his house. God moves in, Yeshua steps aside. It's all yours. Here are the keys, the kingdom, God. So it's the same process. What Moses goes through and what Yeshua goes through is identical in comparison, which is pretty awesome. It gives me the confidence to say, okay, if I'm looking for what people always use, sort of, I'm trying to find Jesus in the Old Testament. Where's all seven Jesus? Read Moses. He's all over it. Okay. Everything Moses does is Jesus. It's the same guy practically. Just swap the names out. And obviously it's physical here for Moses and spiritual for Messiah, but the same principle, the process is identical. The symbols are the same. These are the same characters. Just different names, different times, the same purpose. So these are pretty awesome. In my opinion, everything Moses does, God directs. I said, in my opinion, that's by definition, because it says so. And Yeshua said the exact same thing. Everything that God, that he does, God directs. So they're all being directed to turn over the house of God. In Moses' time, it was the Mishkan, the temple, or tabernacle, sorry. And of course, in Messiah's day, or whatever that, we could discuss that, there's theological discussions around that topic when that happens, that gets all turned over to God as far as when Yeshua is done building this house. Does that make sense? Any questions, comments regarding this portion? It's always useful in my mind to compare these men, because these two men have a lot of parallels throughout their existence, throughout their lives. That's one of the main reasons how I at least identify different detailed aspects of Messiah. Just read what did Moses do? What happened to Moses? Or if I wasn't sure, I'd be thinking about Moses. Well, how does this apply to Messiah in some way? In this case, a lot of it does. Anne, you had a question? Go ahead.
I'm so going to go back to the previous diagram you made and ask, okay, so Moses took the oil and he anointed each of the items. And then the blood, though, when did the blood come in with Aaron at that point? Is that what?
No, not yet. Yeah, the blood doesn't come in until, I think it's 2 weeks later. I think it's 2 weeks later or thereabouts. So, or maybe it's a week later. It's a certain number of days later, Aaron comes in. So put that blood up here with my bowl of blood. The process of purification, because it had to be Aaron and his, at this time, I think it was all four sons. I could be wrong. Maybe just two sons at the time. He was his two oldest sons. I'll scratch these last two guys out. They have to have blood put on them, and the blood's put on the different items while they're all being purified. But that takes place after Moses is done. So Moses has the whole thing functionally up and blessed, and God's cloud has moved in. And now for Book of Leviticus, we'll cover this as Leviticus goes through. It's the whole process of how the people, ordinary schmoes like myself, make our way back into that to the house of God. How do we get back in? God moved in, we had to move out. Now how do we get back in? And this whole blood process is how we move back in. Okay. All right? So Moses makes the whole thing start, but then when he's finished, God moves in. God says, I now accept this as my house. So Moses establishes the house, has it blessed, bless the people, anoints it. God, it's yours. God says, yes, I take it. It's now mine. From that point forward, in order for people to visit God, everything has to be purified because we're all contaminated. You got sins, transgressions, iniquities to be addressed, and everything else, and all the intermixing of those things from the people themselves. And because those people are then using these items, these furniture items inside the tabernacle, they've got to be purified every year at least through blood to keep them cleaned or pure, paid for all the sins and iniquities the people had. But Moses, that's not the case. He didn't have that problem. And of course, obviously, that's Yeshua. It's already been done. He anointed it, but it's on blood in Yeshua's case, but he anointed it. It's now his. He has full reign of walking in, and it requires blood to make the ordinary people to go in. Does that make sense? So these are two different events. Moses does his stuff first. Then shortly thereafter, a week roughly, thereabouts, give or take, goes by as Aaron and his sons then start their process. And they their blood soaking their bodies or on their body parts and such, and the furniture and the clothing and such, that takes place afterward. Does it make sense?
Yes. What about the red heifer? Red heifer.
They're for dead bodies. Yes. The red heifers are for dead bodies.
Is that
Yeah.
Okay.
So if let's say this guy here, we'll call him Jim Croaks, right? He died. Poor Jim. Okay. His best friend and confidant and buddy, Bob, was next to him. Oh no, Jim died. Bob picked him up and buried him. We'll put dirt all over Jim's body. Well, guess what? Bob, you're not contaminated. Can't come in. You're done. If you want to come in, you have to purify yourself, not with just ordinary blood, but then they have a cow called the red heifer, the little bushy tail. I can't not draw a heifer. Or a dog. Okay, it's supposed to be a head heifer. We'll just put an R, red, and we'll put an H for heifer. Okay, or red. It's not a red dog, okay? So this one, okay, don't harass me. So the red heifer dies, the ashes, they have to burn it, ashes come up, so ash water, more specifically, has to be dumped on Bob on, I think it's day number 3 and number 7. I could be off. I think it's day number 3, day number 7. And then he can offer his offerings of animal, whatever, and then come back into God's house. That's where the red heifer comes into place.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.